Welcome to the Sleep is a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. Today's guest is Jeffrey Dermer. He's a systems neuroscientist, neurologist, and sleep medicine physician with a particular expertise in technology-enabled sleep health delivery systems. And part of the reason I was very excited to have him on the show today is because this year he was one of the first staff members on an Olympic team that solely specializes in sleep. Now, since 2013, he has been helping athletes in various sports as a sleep consultant to optimize their performance through sleep programs. And a little background on him, he began his career at the University of Pennsylvania studying the neurophysiology of central nervous systems that generate sleep and circadian rhythms in animals. Currently, he is the chief medical officer of Knox Health, a US-based international telemedicine, sleep, healthcare, and technology firm. And at Knox Health, he oversees the creation and application of platform population sleep health clinical programs, the integration of sleep medical devices to provide scalable solutions and clinical research programs. And prior to Knox Health, he co-founded Fusion Health, the first population sleep health platform company in the US, and Fusion Sleep, an Atlanta-based AASM accredited multidisciplinary sleep medicine program that continues to serve tens of thousands of children and adults with sleep and circadian disorders. He is a former director of Emory University Sleep Laboratory and Pediatric Sleep Medicine Program, where he trained graduate students, medical students, residents, and fellows. You're going to be really, really excited about this conversation we get into today. I think of particular interest to our audience is his expertise on wearables and how to think about the data that's coming from wearables, what to pay attention to and what to maybe put aside. Some of the protocols that he brought in for Olympic athletes in this past year that yielded, you know, certainly in our estimation, helped contribute to the really positive results that resulted in his participation with that Olympic team. And furthermore, we get into some of the strategies that even if you're an athlete, if you're not an athlete, that you can bring in to make a difference with your sleep tonight. And welcome to the Sleep is a Skill podcast. I could not be more excited for this conversation. And as I just shared before we started with Jeffrey, I am just going to try to control myself on not asking him too many questions today, because he is a wealth of knowledge and actually just returned from working with none other than on the Olympic team on the US side. And we could not be more thrilled to discuss sleep from your vantage point. So welcome, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Molly, for having me on.
Oh, fantastic. So I want to just dive right in because I know there's many different arenas that we could explore today, and wanted just to give you an opportunity to share how you found yourself in this line of work, why you're passionate on this topic, and what brought you to the Olympics.
Well, by way of background, it's kind of how I got interested in sleep and circadian neuroscience to begin with. So I'm an MD, PhD by background, and that means that I straddle the fence between the bench and the bedside. And that's where MD, PhDs work. So oftentimes we're only in academics and we tend to live in those little ivory towers our whole careers. I was in that ivory tower working as a neurologist and a neuroscientist at University of Pennsylvania, and after that at Emory University in Atlanta. And what I found is that a lot of the great discoveries that we have to offer people are really kind of not available to a lot of people. So I was really interested in a consciousness, to be honest with you, in the beginning. And that's where I did a lot of my work and research with neurocognitive consequences of things like sleep deprivation, and spent time working on understanding the impact of certain areas of the brain as a neuroanatomist, that actually a neurophysiologist, that affect consciousness. And one of the things that really struck me was that sleep itself is a change in consciousness. It's a change in state. And once you start to look at it, at all of the neurology and the nervous system from that lens, you start to understand that a full third of our life is spent in this other state. And it's not just one state. It's not a monolith itself. There's REM and there's non-REM sleep, and there's wake. And those are the three things that we live in, those three states. So I've been studying wake my whole life and orienting and consciousness. And I realized there's two other states that I haven't really looked at. So from some basic anatomy in the laboratory and basic physiology with some animal models, I decided that sleep would be a great way to apply what we know about our consciousness and the changes in our body, not just our brain, that happen at night in REM and non-REM. And how does that affect our day-to-day performance? And how does it affect our neurodevelopment? How do we become who we are? And what is sleep's role? Because we spend a third of our life doing it. So it must be important, right? That's probably the part of the holy grail for anybody who's interested in sleep science and circadian neurobiology is, why are we doing this? And there's a lot of questions around that. Not many answers, a lot more questions. And that led me into the science of it. And so I basically backed into sleep, neurology-based sleep work and circadian rhythm disorders from the science. So as a scientist, I look at everything I do in a systematic fashion. And even when I approach different populations like the Olympic team, I look at it from a data collection and science program. Are we actually affecting outcomes? Are we changing performance? What's the benefit of what we're doing? And are we using some valid concepts that come out of neuroscience?
Wow, fantastic. Well, you're one of the first people on this podcast that have brought it back to the bigger topic of consciousness from a place to stand as it relates to sleep. So great place to begin. And from that place, how did you bridge the gap from that data, from that kind of higher level perspective, and to the practical application with your role working with the Olympics?
The Olympics is something that kind of evolved. I grew up actually rowing. So I was a rower and I played a lot of sports and I was on the US team at one point way back in the 80s when nobody remembers what rowing was. And I had a lot of experience around sports. My three of my four oldest kids are all like US level swimmers. So we have this ethic of wanting to be in sports for some reason in our household. I don't know why. That has always been in the background, even through all the science and the academics and the work within neurology. But I love to find ways as an MD PhD to apply what I've learned into populations and find ways to affect outcomes. And even within the academic world, that's kind of hard to do because you only have a small touch point with people. So bridging it out into the population through public-based or population-based programs is what I'm really interested in. And our company that we developed outside of original academic mission to study sleep and study circadian neurobiology was this company that we developed called Knox Health. And it's really the bridge. It's the bridge that we created as one of the co-founders of the company to bring the science of sleep and circadian rhythm neurobiology into the big populations that need them. So we first started working with big companies that are trucking companies around the country and airlines, that some of the biggest names that you know. And then slowly but surely, the outcomes of those programs showed that we can really affect not just people's mood and how they feel when they wake up, when they feel better, but also the cost of their healthcare goes way down, 25, 30% reductions in healthcare. We can also show workplace accidents go down and lives get better in all of these different spheres. So that's something that led me to think, well, this is an obvious application to athletics and to sports and performance. So I tried it out with my own kids and my swimmers and taught them about how to think about the night before a big meet and how you have to prepare days in advance and get the extra sleep you need. And then we have all this data now about sleep banking, which is how to increase the amount of sleep in small increments up to your events. And especially in swimming, where you have morning prelims and finals in the afternoon over a course of many days, there's a lot of sleep deprivation involved in that activity. So if you can bank a little of extra sleep, 15, 30 minutes more than you normally sleep, when you get to the event, even though you are sleep deprived, you'll have the benefit of having that banked sleep. And there is a lot of data that shows that that's significant benefit for performance. So I did that with my kids. They all started to talk to their friends about it. They're high-level swimmers. The teams pulled me in to talk to them. I helped the Emory swim team as well. My daughter was on University of Virginia, a few other places. My son's at Northwestern. And it went from there to, let's see if this applies. Other programs found out about us. And all of a sudden, I was the sleep and circadian performance physician for the Atlanta Falcons. So we were living in Atlanta at the time. So the Falcons asked for this help and we worked with them and I worked with them as their physician for number of years with colleagues from Emory, but I did it outside of Emory through my direct, through our company that was doing this population-based approach of putting science into practice. And then through that work, I worked with a bunch of CrossFit athletes. My wife is a powerlifter, and her powerlifting friends were asking me to be on their podcast. So just like this, yep. I was on a couple of Olympic weightlifter podcasts, and they got it through to the head coach of the team, Mike Gattone, and Phil Andrews, the CEO of USAW or weightlifting. And they said, well, Doc, this would be a great idea for the U.S. Weightlifting team. And they're like, all right, let's try it out. And so for 3 or 4 years now, we've been building programming into the weightlifting programs around the country to improve the use of sleep and circadian neurobiology for performance. And then it culminated this year with the Olympics, because we had a significant problem this year to solve, which was more than any other year, not just the COVID issue, which we all had to deal with. And it was tough on the athletes and the families more than anybody else. But it was the difficulty of only being in country for a short period of time, because once your event was over, you had 2 days and had to leave. There was no hanging around the village, taking a tour of Tokyo, and people really couldn't be in country in the village for very long. So what we devised was a plan to actually make a base camp that was partway to Tokyo in Honolulu, Hawaii. And that is really where things became more interesting scientifically, because we could delay people as they were trying to get to Tokyo. It's a 13-hour delay from New York City and East Coast. We had to delay people to Hawaii first and then delay them to Tokyo. So it was a nice halfway point and gave them 3 weeks to adjust to the new time zone and to start delaying for Tokyo. So when they landed and had 4 or 5 days before their event, they're pretty much ready to go. That's what really led to the work with the Olympic team, was how do we manage this crazy mess that we're kind of handed with COVID and the limitations. And I have to say, it was a very successful Olympic Games for our U.S. weightlifting team. We had 2 women get medals, a silver and a bronze, and our first 2 bronzes in a row from Sarah Robles, our super heavyweight lifter. These were unprecedented in modern times for the weightlifting team. Now, there have been other Olympics where we've had medals, but there's a huge drought. If you look at the history of weightlifting in terms of the level at which they performed, it was really remarkable to see that effect. And again, we can't point to sleep or circadian rhythm as the cause. Certainly, it's because of their athleticism and the great work that they did. But it's another part of the preparation that they had, and they used it, which was really a wonderful change to see elite athletes, you know, really grasp it and take it and use it, which I think elite athletes tend to see those things as very important to themselves. Oftentimes professional athletes, even though they're elite, they have many other things on their plate and they tend to be pulled in different directions, and sleep and circadian rhythms tend not to rise to the top, especially if you're also trying to percolate your new rap career and you're up late at night and doing rap stuff. We've had that problem within the NFL in particular. So,
wow. Well, number one, I mean, even for anyone listening, I think you can find yourself in this story in a lot of ways. So one, even if you're not a elite athlete, certainly anticipatory anxiety, stressors that are really, really mounting, and how to prepare for that accordingly. This concept of our kind of sleep bank is really, really valuable. I definitely want to hear more about that. And then being prepared when traveling and having a strategy by which we can work within this concept where we might have had a preconceived notion that, okay, you got to suffer and you got to be sleep deprived and all of these sort of notions. And you're speaking to this new possibility that we can actually bring some science. I love that kind of science in practice concept. So from that place, I'm wondering if you can share a bit more about on the ground. So one, they get there and they have their big lineup of events that now they've got a lot of pressure on them. Yeah. How do you work with people around that? Is that a lot of the psychological components? Is it the structural components around just sleep regularity leading up to that? In addition, is there a whole framework? How do we think about all this?
Yeah, it's a big ball, right? It's like a whole bunch of things combined into one. So how do we make sense of it? That's always the issue. And so just a general comment about this in terms of performance, psychology and your mental, emotional well-being is a big factor in any kind of performance. I mean, especially for things like weightlifting, where it's really about you and that bar and that incredible amount of weight you're about to put over your head that could actually kill you if you think about it, right?
Yes.
So there's a huge fear component, getting over that fear component. You see it in the faces of every lifter when they get up there. But that's true across all sports, but in different ways and in different dimensions. So mental preparedness is, I have to say, as is equal or more important than the physical requirements at the moment. And so what sleep does actually is it creates the changes in your brain. I mean, every night you go to sleep, you repackage neurochemicals. Those neurochemicals like dopamine, all the monoamines, norepinephrine, melatonin, everything that you use on a day-to-day basis that gives you that great mood when you wake up, that feeling, refreshed feeling, that's all because you've repackaged neurochemicals and you've gone through a whole bunch of natural cycles during night and nighttime that actually replenish a lot of the muscle and body needs that you don't get if you don't sleep. So yeah, it's a big part and parcel of your psychology and your physical preparedness. And so like working directly with the team psychologist and the sports psychologist and the team doctor and the dietitian, we work together as a performance team. It's certainly not one group more than the other. We're all focused on the athletes and their specific needs. For those of us who are not elite athletes, and maybe my kids going to their swim team, or even, you know, just your weekend warriors, how do you prepare yourself? One of the things that's most important, I think, in terms of understanding sleep is the same thing we teach to our fellows and our residents around sleep, about sleep, the basic physiology and the neuroanatomy or the neurophysiology. And that is that sleep can be divided into three distinct components. One is sleep duration, the amount of time you sleep over a 24-hour period, the timing of your sleep, as you mentioned earlier, regularity, that's a big component and circadian component. And then the third one is quality of sleep. And it's a little more obtuse in construct. I mean, the idea that quality, what do you mean by quality? There can be a number of things that actually affect quality. And it turns out that a lot of our behaviors predicate our sleep duration and our sleep timing. So your behaviors, like what you do before you go to bed, if you're watching a television or if you're getting blue light in your eyes or any kind of light, you're actually shutting off your sleep system and activating your wake system. That's behavioral though. You can shut that off. You can get rid of that device. You can also schedule your sleep in a way that makes it more regular and not be, you know, sort of dependent on whatever hits you and have a regular routine. So those can be very much behaviorally trained. And so that's one of the things we'd spend a lot of time with athletes and anybody with a sleep issue to talk about regularity of sleep. What are the behaviors? We even use things like cognitive behavioral approaches to really help people learn about their sleep. What are the thoughts about sleep and their behaviors that may be actually counterproductive? But the third one, duration, quality, is a really difficult one for people to factor in. And that's where a lot of folks get like wearables and they put apps next to their bed and people record each other going, you snored last night. I mean, these are all quality issues. You don't believe it till you hear it, but those are quality issues that fall within actually what we do in the medical realm. So the sleep medicine side of things or the sleep medical healthcare part of it is really figuring out what quality issues are we dealing with that could actually be sleep disorders. That's a real need within our population, our culture itself. If you look across the United States, we're in a point right now where sleep is getting worse on a night-to-night basis, not just duration, which is only around 6.2 hours per night, which is a really low amount of sleep for working adults during the week. And then what the bigger issue is that those 6.2 hours have a whole bunch of quality issues. So no matter how much more of that poor quality sleep you get, or how much more regular you make that poor quality sleep, you're still going to have poor quality. And that's going to be the trump card. That's the part that's going to cause the problems. So we really have to unwind the issues for people. They often come in with complaints of, I just don't sleep well, or I've been a light sleeper, or I was told that I move or snore and I don't believe it, or I'm sleepy in the daytime and I can't get to sleep at night. Those are symptoms. The real issue is peeling back. Do we have, first off, behavioral issues that are approached that really affect duration and timing? Or do we have a real quality issue? Do we have sleep disordered breathing, like sleep apnea? Do we have restless leg syndrome, periodic limb movement disorder? Is there a psychophysiologic insomnia with cortical arousal that's occurring through the night? These are questions that can't really be answered by us as individuals, but we really need to talk to a sleep physician. And so that's where we integrating myself as a sleep physician and a neuroscientist into a group or into a team, I can actually pull, and I did, a couple of athletes out and do a polysomnogram on them and see what their sleep actually looks like at the level of the of what we know from the science and from the medicine. And in fact, I found a couple of athletes that needed therapies that were actually quality-based issues. And these are elite athletes in the top physical shape of their lives. I've seen it in many sports. I mean, football has it just because of the size of people. They're very big people. Sure. The bigger the athlete, the bigger the chest and abdomen, the more movement that has to happen to breathe at night. Unfortunately, the upper airways are not as big as the rest of their body. They're about the same as everybody else. And so you take a deep breath, you suck that airway closed, and now you've got sleep apnea in a very healthy young adult that needs to be treated. And I can't tell you the effects that I've seen and the feedback that I've had from athletes saying, wow, did not believe I could sleep like this. And the results are in the outcomes from seeing what they could do. So if you can really break it down for yourself, and when you think about it, is my timing of sleep generally pretty good? Do I stay in the same zone within about an hour of sleep onset and wake up time from weekday to weekend? Now, that's hard for folks on a shift. 20% of people in the United States work a shift, like doctors and nurses and police and firemen. That's tough. I mean, that's where your real issue could be if you have a problem with maintaining a regular schedule. And there is even a number of sleep disorders like circadian rhythm sleep disorders that we know about and we can treat. There are ways to treat those without medicines that we can use, light therapies and avoidance therapies and a whole bunch of other things. But then there's also duration. So can you effectively keep your duration the same every night? Can you get about that 8 hours that we all need about on average? Athletes need a lot more. So most people say 7.5, but it really comes out to about 8. Athletes need at least, depending on their sport and the metabolic output that they have, the more metabolic output, the more sleep they need to replace the ATP that they use during their daytime. That's actually something that we can even chart. We can show that certain sports like boxing and rowing, swimming have these very high metabolic equivalents that if you're swimming all day, you know, in practice, the amount of metabolic outcome is huge compared to other sports like racket sports where you may not move as much within a small area or they're more incidental, or even sports like weightlifting where it's immediate release of activity and rest. So the metabolic equivalents really determine the amount of sleep you need. And in some cases, the average is like 10 to 11 hours in adults. You see people like LeBron James talk about that. He needs mm-hmm. to get his 11 hours of sleep. That's because he puts out a lot of energy and he needs that sleep to recoup and to refocus for the next day. So if you do those things right and you think your duration and your timing's good, but you still feel like, I just don't feel right. Oh, it's just getting older. Well, no, it's not. It's probably something in your sleep quality that's led to your sleep not being as effective or efficient. And that's where you need to talk to a sleep specialist, a sleep physician. And there's a whole bunch of board certified sleep physicians around the country. Not as many as we need, for sure. It's a very underserved population, but certainly within most academic health systems, you'll find them. And then also through telemedicine programs like ours, you can get them directly through like the Knox Health program we have.
Wow. Okay. So from that place, a lot of the people listening are wearing some sort of tracker, consumer grade tracker. And I know you know a lot about this topic, yeah. And in particular, as it compares to medical grade pieces of tech. So I'm wondering if, you know, people listening might say, oh, okay, well, I've checked the boxes on some of those categories you mentioned. And some of those categories you mentioned, it feels like from my data that I'm not getting whatever proper amount of sleep regularity. And then some people going into sleep stages, which we also know has some concerns around the mm-hmm. sleep stage classification on a lot of these trackers and the accuracy there. So I'm wondering if you have any guidance when people are beginning to get into this conversation. So one, hopefully we're, you know, applauding that people are beginning to kind of, no pun intended, wake up to this topic. And yet, right. But are we, do you have words of caution when people mm-hmm. are leading into some of these, a whole approach to the wearable topic?
Yeah. I mean, there is certainly a lot more interest. And I think just like you said, this is a great opportunity to bring up sleep issues because people are more aware of them. And I think that's really that's the message, that it's great that people are using wearables. I think, you know, there's a lot of concern within the sleep medicine community itself about the validity of these devices and the clinical utility of them. But again, that's for a very different purpose. That's, is this diagnostic? Well, no, these are not diagnostic devices. Our other side of our company, we do this big population health group, a part of our company called Sleep Charge. The other half of our company is all engineering. We actually, there's another company called Knox Medical under Knox Health. We make the world's leading sleep testing devices. And these sleep testing devices are used in every country that uses, that does sleep testing. And they're the first portable devices that people have used at home, the home sleep apnea testing devices. We developed the very first one in our engineering group. And since then, have evolved them to do actual home polysomnography. So almost the whole polysomnogram you have to go to a lab to do, you can do at home. But that's medical grade data. That is scientifically proven. Clinical evidence, FDA approval, all those things go into building those devices and years of technology development. That said, when you look at the consumer electronic area and the sleep and arousal activity that is registered in these devices, there are some things that are valid, that are interesting and useful about these devices, especially if you look at it from the perspective of you using it as your own baseline and comparing against yourself. It's hard to use it generically across the population because it's not clinically validated. But you can use it for yourself to see what changes from night to night. What variables can you tweak? So if you go to bed a little earlier, what happens to your sleep quality and what happens to how you feel in the morning? And even some of these trackers actually give you like a awakening score, a score about how well you're prepared for the day, your preparedness score. That sort of stuff can be very helpful for folks to change their behaviors. And this is the thing I think it's most useful about these devices. I mentioned earlier the DTQ, the duration, timing, quality concept. Well, duration and timing, again, are behavioral in many ways. There are some circadian rhythm disorders, so it's not entirely, but largely your behaviors can impact those two. That's where the wearables come in. The wearables themselves have the ability to tell you a little bit about when you're awake and when you're asleep. They tell you a little bit about how that sleep period itself was compared to the previous sleep period. So was there a lot more activity than there was in a previous sleep period? And it can tell you if your sleep timing is close night to night, is it pretty close to what you normally do? Again, they're not devices that are clinically valid about like telling you exactly when you fell asleep or exactly when you woke up. But in general, when you look at the bigger picture, it can give you at least an idea of how you're doing with your duration and your timing. One thing to know about all devices that are out there in the marketplace, they all have something in them called accelerometers or actigraphy as another term for it, which actually is a three-dimensional analysis of movement. So the movement itself is very fine movement. It could be on your wrist or your finger or on your hip. Those tell you about the movement of your body. That's actually where they first really became interesting devices. And they were used for exercise because the more movement, the more exercise, right? Well, it doesn't work really well for things like CrossFit if you're doing pull-ups because your hands are the same place the whole time. So we all know that. But like running and walking and things that involve movement really do track well with these devices. Well, the same thing was found about sleep that, hey, there's no movement. So that must be sleep. It's not really sleep until you actually apply some more algorithms and use things like heart rate variability, as well as oximetry and a number of other, you can use a number of other things like skin conductance, skin temperature. There's even other kinds of pulse oximetry in some devices that you can get that are even like medical grade level oxygen sensing. So those are kinds of those are the additional components on top of the accelerometry. The movement that have evolved over time. And each device is a little bit different. So some devices are really good at heart rate variability, and that's what you want it for. Others are really great at pulse oximetry and telling your oxygen levels, and you use it for that. So there are some that are out there, like the Apple Watch that was used in a large scale AFib study. So if you have AFib, you might want to get an Apple Watch. If you're an athlete and you want to wear something that's not obtrusive, that doesn't get in your way, and that you really are using for sleep only, you might want to use something like the Oura ring, like a little ring on your finger. There are a lot of different options. The Fitbit is probably the longest in data sets of all of the companies out there. So Fitbit has a number of other devices that have been tested against polysomnography, as well as others like the Oura Ring. Jawbone has done some studies against polysomnography, Polar, Basis, Withings, a number of these companies. And what you find, though, invariably, is that the proprietary algorithms built into each of these devices have incredibly different comparisons against the polysomnograph. So
yes,
you really can't say that these are valid tools, and we have the data to show those, but some are better at certain things. So if you want something that's really good at like sleep and wake, just determining those components, there are some that are better at that. So the Oura Ring, for instance, is quite good at that. I think one of the Polar devices is also quite good at that. And one of the Fitbits is really good at that. But not all devices have the same properties. So you really got to think, what is it that I want this device for? The one thing they all don't do well, though, is talking about REM and non-REM sleep, yes, light and deep sleep. They really don't function well. And it's not an error. It's not like because they're poor quality. It's just that they're not able to detect brain activity, which actually is what a polysomnogram does. And we have multiple leads, like an EEG on your head. So that's where we find the fine tuning and knowing exactly where your brain is arousing, what kinds of activities are happening at night. That's why we really can't depend on these devices quite yet, because AI and machine learning is not able to do this kind of an analysis yet. Now, maybe in the future, when we get enough data, we'll be able to do a heck of a lot more. But at this point, they're not really set up to do quality assessments. And another thing to think about too is if you are suffering with a sleep problem, like a snoring issue or restlessness or insomnia, it's actually demonstrated that these consumer electronics are even worse in terms of being effective at giving you feedback. Because if you have a sleep disorder, it throws off the algorithms.
Yes.
So for normal sleepers, it works one way. For people with not normal, quote unquote, sleep, it doesn't work the same. So that's another problem that the industry is right now going through a number of clinical trials with these devices against actual medical grade devices to see if they can be used in research studies, because it's a heck of a lot easier to put some ring on a finger than it is to put somebody in a laboratory in an unnatural environment. And you can do the ring on the finger days and days and days. You can only do a polysomnogram in really one night or a couple of nights if you do a polysomnogram at home with one of the devices like we make. So there's a real need to have this for science, as well as for practical applications.
Absolutely. So in your work with athletes, are you finding that there are particular metrics on a day-to-day basis that you're kind of have in your language that you're speaking to them about, whether it is blood oxygen, HRV, basic regularity, there are certain things that you really go to?
Yeah, I really focus on the behavioral metrics more than I do with things like heart rate variability. Yeah. I mean, honestly, if I see something that looks very like far on the spectrum one way or the other for things like heart rate variability, I bring up like other issues. Like heart rate variability can be affected by alcohol, it can be affected by caffeine, it can be other substances, medications. Heart rate variability can be affected by other conditions, hypertension, heart disease, lung disease, pulmonary issues. Those are questions I'll bring up if I see something in heart rate variability. But I try not to put too much emphasis on things like heart rate variability, only because we really don't have enough data, even in the science, to say this equals disease or this equals problems. We do know, though, that if your sympathetic nervous system is supercharged at night, that's not a good thing. And so that's why we want to see your heart rate variability higher than lower, because the higher your heart rate variability, the more parasympathetic, relaxing, resting, restorative, digestive, all of those parts of the nervous system become active. And we shut down these hyperactive daytime sympathetic surges, which all athletes need, but you really need to flip the switch at night. And in fact, we do know in the medical literature, at least, that heart rate variability in people with diseases like coronary artery disease or heart failure or major medical issues like that, we know that heart rate variability is a very important predictor in terms of subsequent heart attacks. Like if you don't have a lot of heart rate variability, it's likely you're at a higher risk for a second heart attack or for a stroke potentially, because you have less reserve to actually have a sympathetic parasympathetic change. You're kind of stuck in one position. So there are some utilities, but we're not quite there with the devices yet in terms of, it's really a science. It's a scientific pursuit of the arousal system and the subcortical systems associated with sympathetic and parasympathetic balance. And certainly there are some applications clinically. At this point, we're still early on, so I wouldn't put a lot of credence in it. I would try to use your devices to really help change your behaviors. Like I tell you, do an experiment. If you have one of these devices, if you drink alcohol, have some friends over, have some beer, have some wine, have some cocktails, and then go to sleep. And then the next night or the night before that, don't drink anything. Look at the difference in your sleep with just having alcohol. You'll be impressed by how different things are. When your heart rate actually comes down, it usually comes down in the first half of the night and it'll come back up in the second half. But if you drink alcohol, it's going to stay high all through the night until you get that alcohol out of your system, your liver metabolizes, it goes back down. But then you go in all those REM stages toward the morning and it pops back up again. So your heart really never got the rest that it needed in terms of its activity level. And that's true for the brain activity. It's true for your body and the physiology in your GI tract, which we know the GI tract is the second largest nervous system in your body outside of your brain. So think of it that way.
Absolutely. And to that point, were there certain things that you brought in with your athletes leading up to big events, big games that were sort of a clear, even checklist by which for them to kind of operate within or a way to think about some of those just low hanging fruit and maybe higher hanging fruit?
Well, the low hanging fruit was simple. The low hanging fruit was, let's work on regularity. I know there are some of you that are late night sort of owl types, and then you got the morning lark group. Let's get you guys focused on getting a regular base. Even if you're a night owl, let's have a regular night owl schedule for you. Let's do it on a regular basis. Let's not force you into this early morning thing during the weekdays and then you reverberate back on the weekends. That's just going to create problems leading up to whatever performance you're doing. And also look at the performance. You know what day that performance is on. You know the time of day oftentimes that you have to perform. For weightlifting in particular, it's a specific hour of event.
Yeah.
So we can actually plan backwards from that point and say, all right, your performance is going to be on Wednesday at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. All right, you are somebody who has a delayed circadian rhythm. That's great, because 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to be more awake than somebody with an early lark rhythm. So we don't have to adjust your circadian rhythm too much, but you have to go across 5 time zones to do that. So let's track back where 5 time zones is where you're working out right now. And let's slowly shift you towards that new time zone as you work out in preparation for that performance. So that's the low-hanging fruit, is really creating some regularity and get the schedules aligned with your performance as much as you can. The second low-hanging fruit is, are you getting enough sleep? And are you getting the adequate amount of sleep, or are you not? And that's something that is independent of sort of averages and, you know, what the CDC says, you should have average 7.5 hours of sleep. It's whatever you need. And that's something I like to metric right up front with all the athletes. And what is your average sleep time when you're on vacation? What's your average sleep time when you don't have the pressure of performance or the pressure of work? And it's easy to figure that out. That's something you can do yourself by just taking a couple of days on a long weekend and just getting rid of alcohol and caffeine and just see what your natural cycle looks like. And once you know that, we can use that. And then, you know, the other thing I did with all the athletes is also ask them a series of questions and some validated questionnaires. I use the athletic sleep questionnaire, which is developed really for athletes at this level. And it's athlete sleep behavior questionnaire. And it goes through a series of behaviors and the associated issues that they may be noting. And it really gives me a fine-tuned way of looking at, well, your specific issue is you're looking at social media at night, and you should be putting that thing away. Let's talk about that. So it gives me the ability to focus in on the different issues that they may be having in a quantifiable way. Now, in a clinical scenario, when you come to see a doctor, you're going to get those questions as part of your consultation, your interview. But if you want to look at a large group of people, you kind of use you have to use something that's standardized, that gives you the group itself, and you can actually start to interject benefits for the individuals in the group based on the responses. So that's what I typically did with the group. And the other thing I did was I used the morningness, eveningness questionnaire. It's an old questionnaire that was developed way back in the 70s. And there's a number of different versions of it. It's like 19 questions. And just by answering whether or not you're more morning, evening, in the middle, I can determine your chronotype. So if you're a lark or somebody who's a night owl or somewhere in between. And that helps us to tune your schedules and tune what you do to optimize your performance. Those are the things we start with. And then simple quality questions. Do you snore? Do you move? Are you up? Do you have difficulty falling asleep at night? Do you have difficulty staying asleep at night? The most common form of insomnia. Does anybody tell you that you kick a lot and you find the sheets off? Are you a hot sleeper? Do you sweat at night? Do you have nightmares? Do you have occasion when you wake up and you're in the middle of your kitchen? You don't know how you got there. There's a number of different parasomnias we would want to know about. And then the circadian rhythm issues associated with timing as well, we'll ask about. And then issues of sleepiness. Do you nap during the day? Do you tend to use a lot of caffeine during the day? Do you have to use sleeping pills to sleep at night? Does it help you? Does it make your sleep worse? A lot of these questions about quality and what you've been doing, and oftentimes we find it in sleep medicine in general, we take people off a lot of things. We don't give them a lot of things. I know that everybody out there thinks, oh, sleep medicine knows doctors. They give Ambien out. They do. They give them. So, no. In fact, we take people off the Ambien that their primary care doctor put them on or that they got as a sample. We take people off of SSRIs that were used for sleep that are causing all kinds of other side effects and symptoms. We really try to get people back to the understanding that sleep is a natural, it's a natural effect. It's a natural behavior. It's like eating. I mean, there are eating disorders for sure, but we realize that that's not because you need a medicine. It's because of other issues related to your behavior. And so if we can actually, we can peel back the onion a little bit, we can figure out how to get people back to the natural state of sleeping. There are very few genetic conditions that cause sleep to be interrupted that actually require medications or medical therapies. Things like narcolepsy, things that, like there are idiopathic insomnias that occur in a very small number of people. But the vast majority of the problems that people have with their sleep can be often made better or solved with just getting better behaviors around sleep as a first step. Now, you're not going to treat your sleep apnea with a behavior. You're not going to treat your RLS necessarily with a behavior, or in some cases, you may need medications for certain things and therapy devices like positive airway pressure for apnea. But those are things that we can add once we find out about those issues.
Sure. So I think that's really, really wise. The emphasis on that behavioral change, the overlooked component to make a difference with their sleep. Often people want to lead with, well, what are the supplements? What are the tools? What are the, you know, exactly. And I'm just also curious if from that athletic standpoint, the hours leading up to sleep, are there certain things that they might do differently? Such an emphasis on hydration throughout the course of the day for all the activity they're doing. How do we tend to that with the sleep-wake cycle? Can they have that proper kind of period of almost fasting before sleep, or do they need to be still taking in more and more calories? Anything that stands out differently for them?
Yeah. For athletes in particular, hydration is always an issue. I mean, for all of us, 70% of us walking around the street are just under I have this next to me for a reason.
Very nice.
So we got to keep the hydration going, people. And so that's something that we always hit on, but a lot of the athletes are quite good at this now because they have anything at their hand, their fingertips is being given to them. Eat this, drink this. Yeah. That's why we have that going on. The issue though becomes like when you're preparing for sleep, one of the things you want to be sure of when you're preparing for sleep is that you're not activating your gastrointestinal system, because your GI tract, as I mentioned earlier, your second largest neuronal system in your body is active when you put food in it. And it's the hotter the food, the spicier the food, the more of the food that you put in, the more difficult to digest the food. Those are all neural stimulants, if you think about it. They're like light to your brain, but it's the light to your stomach is food. So if you put a lot of food into your gut, and especially if it has some complexity to it, you're just asking for trouble. I mean, you're going to look, your body is going to react, your GI system is going to activate, and it's going to cause sleep to be less deep. And it may even cause insomnia, and it may wake you at night as well. So that's the first thing I tell my athletes. If you want to have something before bed, have a shake. Have something that you know is already pre-processed and it has some decent protein in it. It'll keep you up for the night. You won't feel hungry. Don't eat a sandwich. Don't have a pizza. Don't drink beer. You know, stay away from the things that are going to activate the neural access that is your stomach and your GI tract. The second thing is, because we're trying to activate the parasympathetic nervous system in the hour or minutes or hours before sleep, we really want to reduce the amount of novel stimulus. And this is a key factor. The novelty of things often is just as bad as the physiologic light component that we get with computers and social media and phones. So I ask people to really think about building a routine in that makes it boring so that they're not looking at the night as a time to start doing their taxes, to communicate their social media. I mean, all these athletes have these great fan bases and they're sending messages, you know, wherever they are in the world. No. Turn that thing off. If you need your phone by your bed to wake you up, like an alarm, fine, but put it on vibrate, turn it over, make sure you can't see it, eliminate the other light sources and other novelty seeking sources like your television, lights in the room, these incidental lights that happen on every device that you happen to have. I have sometimes actually had tape put over all of them.
Yes.
So I have to get rid of that novel stimulus. That's another thing you can do. And that in turn just reduces the sympathetic surge that you normally have associated with all the novelty. The second thing is you can start to do things that physiologically activate the parasympathetic nervous system to counter any sympathetic surge you may have from what happened today, because everybody's affected by what happened every day, right?
Yeah.
And so one of the things you can do that's very helpful is to use breathing, deep breathing and belly breathing to activate the vagus nerve, and deep belly breathing, like babies breathe, sticking their belly out and breathing in and not using your accessory muscles of your chest, but using your belly to do your breathing is a natural way to breathe. When you do that, you're actually activating the vagus nerve, which is 90% input to the brain, not output. Some of it is output, like to the heart and the brain, to the heart and the GI system and the diaphragm. But the vagus nerve input is a parasympathetic activator. So it shuts down sympathetic nervous system. So I'm taking a deep breath just through the belly and then out. That simple act actually helps to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And for those who are a little more interested in breathing, we can use meditative breathing activities, doing square breath. We can do a number of other activities, and that can in turn create a new routine. It just needs to focus on the breath and do it for like 3 to 5 minutes. It doesn't take long. That associated with a number of other like environmental changes that are simple to make, especially when you're on the road. When you're in a different hotel from different performances or you're on the road, it's great to have something that is regular. Like we do it for our kids. They bring their little bunny with them or their pillow. Well, do that for yourself. Bring your pillow. Don't worry about the pillows there. Bring your one pillow or the one thing that makes you comfortable or the nightshirt you wear or whatever it is that makes you comfortable. Also, bring something and use something that creates a white noise in your background. And this is something I think a lot of athletes grasped onto with the Olympic team, at least. They all had white noise devices that are either on their phones that would create white noise all night long with the notification shut off. And that would create either, you can use natural sounds like wind, waves, water, the 3 W's. So if you use one of those 3 W type sounds, great, but have it go all night long. Don't just have it for an hour. Find one that goes 10 hours and let it go the whole night long. Just like if you had a ceiling fan in your room, have that ceiling fan on all night long. So you get that whir. Also, if you wake up in the middle of the night, and all of us do wake up a little bit at night, that's normal. You can go back to sleep because the conditions are the same. So that's another big one, is the sound in the background. And then the other is keeping the temperature cool and keeping yourself and your body cool. Turns out that one of the triggers for the central nervous system to activate sleep is the central core temperature of your body. And as it goes down, sleep is triggered. So one of the things that some of my athletes, especially our bigger bodied athletes, do is they jump in the shower for like 5 minutes or jump in a tub of water for 5 minutes, actually warm water, not cold water. Like you might think it'd be good. Cold water is fine too, but it's kind of hard to tolerate. Right. But we just put you in a shower that's warm. Doesn't have to be overly hot. A warm shower for a couple of minutes just to warm up your body, get all the blood flow to the surface of the skin. And then you turn that off, step out into a cool room. It will rapidly cool your body. And you'll get a core cooling that you can then use as a trigger for sleep. The other thing to do is also cool you, not necessarily the room. So a lot of people turn the temperature down in their room, but then they put on 3 covers. So the room is 66 degrees, but you're 105 degrees. That's not acceptable. That's not going to work. Your core is the issue. So one of the things that we also implemented for the Olympic team and for the U.S. weightlifting team was the use of bedtop cooling devices. So we had a number, I've worked with a couple of companies that made devices that actually put have microtubules through them. They're like a bed topper that straps onto your bed and goes to a tube that goes to a bedside unit that is full of water, not a lot of water, just a little, and it keeps it at a constant temperature and circulates it through those microtubules. And that's in contact with your body right under a sheet and your clothes. And so it can keep your body at a constant temperature, at least the part of your body that's on the bed, which is the part that often gets hot, especially for those who are hot sleepers. It made all the difference. They had significant benefits in their sleep and they took their devices with them to Tokyo. So
amazing.
So the basic principles of sleep are that you need a cool, quiet, reproducible environment without light. And so if you can do those things and talk to your bedroom, go in your bedroom and take a look at it, talk to it and say, okay, what here is not helping me sleep? Mm. And look around, take a critical evaluation of your bedroom. You'll quickly find things that it's in your bedroom because that's where your bed is. But if you think about what that is, it's a sleep sanctuary. Anything in that room should be about sleep. In fact, the less you have in that room, the more mundane that room is, the more elemental that room is, the better you're going to sleep. Now, if you take out a lot of the fluffy stuff that is in the way that goes up your nose and wakes you up at night, that stuff out of the room, it makes a big difference for people, and they don't even realize it. That's the thing. We often just get so adjusted to our cats on our head or, you know, things like that. Those are not actually good things for your sleep. And if you put your cat in another room, your dog at the foot of the bed, train them to stay out of your bed, big difference. Now, that's not true for everybody. There are people who sleep better with their dogs and their cats, and there's data to show that they do sleep just as well as if they're not in their bed. But if it's causing a problem, if your sleep is not good, you may want to consider that change.
Oh, okay. So many gems. And that actually perfectly leads us into learning a bit from you and how you're relating to your sleep. So on the topic of day-to-day, I'm sure this evolves. You have so much information on this topic. But the first question being, right now, what does your nightly sleep routine look like as it stands today?
My nightly sleep routine, actually, I have to say, just being a scientist and a neurologist in this field doesn't make you good at sleep. It doesn't make you good. You have to practice. You have to, you know, just because you know how to lift weights doesn't make you a weightlifter. You have to practice. So actually, my wife is really good. She's the warden of the sleep for everybody, including my kids.
Oh my God, that's like my fiance too. We call him Night Cop. He's like, all right, let's go.
Yep, that's exactly right. So she's on me like in the middle of the night if I have a paper due or I'm doing something that's a little late. She's like, hey, what are you doing? We got sleep in an hour and a half. What are you doing? I'm like, okay, thanks. And so It's really my personal routine is if I didn't have a wife, I'd be dead. So I give her a lot of kudos for keeping us all on key. I think the other parts of our sleep here, I live in Denver, so near the Olympic Center down in Colorado Springs, and beautiful weather here on a regular basis. So I can't complain about that, except for the smoke that we're getting from California right now. Yes. But other than that, you know, it's temperate. We have great humidity control. We don't have a lot of humidity here, so it's really comfortable. It gets cool at night, even in the summer. So there are a lot of things like we open up the doors, open the windows, and we get natural air and natural sounds in. And that's actually really helpful. Other times, like my wife has a sound app. So she's from Costa Rica originally, and she loves the sound of the rainforest and rain. And so we have rainforest sounds in our bedroom, in our sleep sanctuary. So a little bit of a rain sound. We both have these cooling pads on our bed. So it's something that she's a hot sleeper. It's something about being Latin. I don't know what it is, but she has the cooling mattress. I have one on my side. So we keep it cool. We use the sounds. We actually get a lot of air transfer, a lot of movement of air. That's a really important thing for people to recognize that air quality and movement of air is important. Mm. So we do have ways to move the air. We have a HEPA filter based blower that actually cleans the air and moves the air. And we typically try to have good sleep hygiene. And by sleep hygiene, I mean, we don't drink any caffeine after the morning. We have a cup of coffee in the morning, maybe two at most. And I get the hairy eyeball from my wife on that one, which is appropriate. And, you know, but we don't drink coffee in the afternoons. We don't drink alcohol close to bedtime. If we have drinks with friends, we tend to do it early. And in Colorado in general, people are early to bed and early to rise. It's a syndrome here. So it's a little easier to integrate that into our society, but we avoid late nights. We avoid not parties. We go to parties for sure, but we tend to, because we have our youngest is 8 years old, we tend to get home, you know, and we're not out. It's super late at night. We really try to keep our regularity in place. So, you know, we'll read books and watch sunsets rather than television. So I think that the more nature you can include in the evenings of your day, the better your sleep is going to be. So if you have the ability to, you know, in the winter, even have a fireplace, we have a little one on the roof deck that we have where we watch the sunset. In nice. Denver, you can't have real wood because you can't pollute the environment. So right. we have a little gas thing, but that's all we need. We just go up there and we chill out. We talk, we look at the sunset, watch the stars, you know, and just chill and then go downstairs and get ready for bed. So having that kind of nature exposure, I think is an important part of, for us at least, it's an important part of helping us keep our sleep regular and having good nights of sleep.
Awesome. Okay. So that leads you to doing the more routine part. You get down and you start to settle in for sleep. And then is there anything noteworthy that we might see in your space, environment, on your nightstand, or in the lead up to that?
Well, my wife is, I mentioned earlier, she's a powerlifter, but she retired from that. And she's actually an artist. That's her actual work. And her art has moved her into jewelry making. She actually she forges jewelry. She makes rings.
Very cool.
Yeah, out of silver and gold. And so our bedroom is adorned with all kinds of her art and her friend's art. So it's very universal sort of symbolism. And we're very deco era kind of influenced people. So like our wedding was very kind of Gatsby-ish in theme. And our house has that theme. So if you walked into our bedroom, you'd see a lot of art. You'd see a lot of symbolism. You'd see a lot of crystals. You'd see a lot of malas. You'd see things that really center our belief system around sort of the environment and sort of the universality of I'm by nature sort of I don't have a denomination I would ascribe to religiously, but I would think I'm more of a Buddhist thought person. And I think she is as well, even though she grew up as a Catholic in a Catholic country. Yes. I think that's kind of what you'd be surprised about. You look in and go, wow, you guys are a bunch of hippies. but actually we're not hippies. We're just kind of universal thinkers and we love the freedom of thought here in Denver and Colorado and all the different ways that people experience life here is something that we enjoy and we embrace.
I love that. Wow. Very cool. And in alignment with that on the thought process, has there been a particular thing that you can point to that's made the biggest change to your sleep game or biggest sort of aha moment that has really helped shift and improve your sleep?
For me personally, because I have to say my job and my work is so all over the place that it's a little tension provoking at times because I'm constantly going from one thing to the next. So I think that my wife will always tell me, you know, you're in your head too much, you're thinking too much. Yes. So meditation's been really, really helpful for me. But even more so, what I've noticed physically is that I clench my teeth and I clench when I'm working or grind my teeth. And it was something that was starting to cause pain. And I didn't really recognize it, even as a sleep doctor. I didn't recognize my own issue. And my wife, hey, dummy, smacked me and said, you're grinding your teeth. I'm like, wow, I didn't realize that. So I basically got a little oral appliance that I wear at night. And we do that in our program as well. We provide oral appliances for sleep disordered breathing for apnea.
Sure.
And just the oral appliance for grinding has been a game changer for me, just to get rid of the teeth pain and all the wear and just the tension doesn't go away. Like the job is still tight and it's still intense, but I don't have to suffer the physical ramifications. And that with meditation, I think have been and mindfulness has been very, very helpful for me personally.
Very cool. And just in alignment with that one quick question, what are your thoughts on the mouth tape topic of things at night? Do you subscribe to that or what are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess you'd have to tell me a little bit more about what kind of mouth tape you're talking about.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. More just in that conversation of, I think particularly with James Nestor's book around breath and looking at, if we tape our mouth, we can start to train to nasal breathe a bit more, even if it's 3M surgical tape or, sleep specific tape. Curious if you think that has any validity or not.
I don't know what the result is that would be considered the valid outcome. So hard as a scientist to say that that's valid or not. I don't know what we're trying to prove with that. But I will say there are some potential complications with that concept. One is that a significant number of people, especially those who have snoring as an issue and sleep disorder breathing and apnea, do not have the anatomic ability to breathe through their nose properly. That's not to say that they don't breathe through their nose. It's just that one thing that happens at night when you sleep, and in the day too, is that the turbinates in your upper airway, there's a number of turbinates, but the anterior turbinates swell one side to the other. And you actually only are able to breathe out of one side of your nose at a time. Mm. So if you notice that right now, if you just go, it's a little tighter over here, I can breathe better here. That's because your turbinates are constantly fluctuating back and forth. Well, if you have a deviated septum, or if your upper airway is congested because you have a palate that's retrograde, or if your upper airway collapses on itself, or if you have large adenoids or tonsils, or if your nasal passageway is constricted because of sinus polyps, or just because you have sinusitis, or you might even have allergies that can be much worse at night in some cases, especially with asthma. Those are people that are not going to be able to breathe through their nose.
Yes.
So if you tape their mouth, you're creating much more of a problem than you are a benefit. And it's a large number of people. Genetically speaking, when we look at the complex genetic research that we've done in sleep apnea in particular, what we find in these big phenotype analyses of genomes is that 25, maybe even up to 30% of the population has genetics for sleep disordered breathing, for apnea. That means that if you tape their mouths closed, you're actually making their apnea worse. You could actually cause an arrhythmia. You can cause a lot of downstream negative outcomes. I'm not saying you're going to kill somebody, but we don't want to do that. And especially if it's over the course of multiple nights. So training people to breathe through their nose, I understand I get the premise.
Logic, yeah.
I get the logic, but I don't subscribe to the concept of taping.
Yeah, just the blanket, you know.
Yeah, I think practicing breathing is actually a great thing. And there are a number of breathing techniques that are out there, and I've tried many of them, and they're very effective. If you can do some breathing techniques to learn more about breathing and learn about filling your lungs and how to open your lungs further, you can actually help improve other things, not just sleep. I certainly don't think you want to limit your ability to breathe at night.
Yes, absolutely. Got it. Good. Well, thanks for shining a light on that topic.
Sure.
And with this, I mean, it's just so clear your knowledge. We just only tapped into a little bit of it and so already giving so many gems. So how can people follow more of what you're working on and, you know, be more aligned with what you have to offer?
Sure. Well, if you want to follow what we're doing, I would suggest, you know, we're on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Twitter, we're on online at a website, it's knoxhealth.com. If you want to follow Knox Health and the Sleep Charge program, Sleep Charge is the name of the program we have for all these big populations of folks, from athletes to employers to truck drivers, airline pilots, and CEOs. You can definitely subscribe. You can link with us and follow what we're doing. We do webinars. We do a lot of other activities that are free to the public. People can just jump in and listen, learn about their sleep, learn about the effects of things like wearables. I did a whole webinar on wearables not that long ago.
Ooh, I'd love to see that.
Yeah, these are absolutely available to the public. Come to our website at knoxhealth.com or look up sleepcharge.com. That's the name of the program that we've developed for the employer populations. And, you know, if you have any questions, if you want to talk about having a program with your own company or with your team or whatever you do, just give us a call. Let us know. We'll let you know if we have programming available, if we can do something to help you.
That is so awesome. And just wanted to say one, so appreciate you taking the time to share so much of your wisdom and for the work that you're doing with our athletes. Is there anything that we didn't cover, anything that you'd like to say in closing on this topic of sleep for health and performance?
Well, the one thing we didn't talk about that I want to make everybody aware of is the social epidemic of poor sleep in kids. One thing we're going to talk about, and you know, I work with younger people, they're athletes, younger athletes, and I worked in pediatric sleep medicine for a number of years. And one of the things that we know from incredible amounts of data, and the CDC has been tracking for decades now and has put on the watch list of problems for the country to figure out, is that 66% of school-aged kids going to in the adolescent age group, especially middle school, high school, two-thirds, 66%, don't get enough duration of sleep on a daily basis. Just duration.
Mm.
It's not even taking into account that their timing is off And also their quality may not be good. So we're really at epidemic levels. 66% of our kids are sleep deprived on a day-to-day basis during the week. And their catch-up sleep on the weekend is just actually making it worse because they're learning a behavior for the rest of their lives that's going to put them at risk for cardiovascular disease, metabolic disease, mental health issues, and even immune dysfunction. So we know that that's a big problem. We know the associations with sleep loss, but we've got a whole generation now that's being raised in this construct that sleep is not as important as it really is. So I want to get that across, that if you have kids, make sure you check out the CDC website on just sleep duration. What are the recommendations for your age child? And get them in that range and really become forceful about it. Because these are things that if you remember, you know, generations ago, your grandmother would be like, why are you awake? Get in bed. It was a major issue. You got a lot of flack for not following the sleep-wake regulation rules of grandma. That's not happening these days. We're too fluid. We have too much light at night. We have all these activities and computers. We've got to become much more rigid as a culture and take this as a higher priority because the effect is going to be just like the environment is going to mess up our kids' future. Well, we're already doing it through sleep. So let's get ahead of that. And let's get parents involved in schools and school start times correctly associated with circadian rhythms. So kids are not starting too early in the morning and they're getting the ability to sleep that they need. So that would be my last point.
Wow. Well, and I love that passion too, because we need speakers on that topic because it is so important. And speaking for those who don't necessarily aren't aware of how much sleep that group needs, and certainly for the group itself, we need some real guidance. So that is fantastic. Thank you for making that point. Yep. And anyone listening, be sure to check out and follow Jeffrey's work at knoxhealth.com. And again, just really thank you for taking the time.
My pleasure. Glad to be here. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.